clerk will call the docket.
Lee Holman Moody against the Commonwealth of Virginia, LLC Defender, David C. Reinhardt, the appellant, R. Harper, as Cameron, Attorney General, Dusty M. Holder, Assistant Attorney General for the Appellate.
You may proceed.
Good morning, ma'am. Police Court, my name is Elliot Bender. I represent Mr. Mooney. I'm here. I first request 3 minutes rebuttal time possible. To get started, this case is not that complicated, but has significant implications if the Court of Appeals opinion is to stand as written. What the Commonwealth wants this case to be about is they want you to believe that the issue is whatever was read into the record, and I say that because we don't have a copy of it, so we don't know exactly what it was, other than what the Commonwealth attorney at that time said it was, is non-testimonial. And they want us to assume certain things. One, they want us to assume that it's one in article. One, they just assume it's accurate. One, they want us to assume it was written by a reliable source. Yet, we have none of that evidence before this court, nor was it before the trial court at the time.
Who has the burden of proof of establishing it as testimonial for purposes of excluding it from evidence?
Well, one, I think that we can look at it to determine whether it's testimonial. I think that the standard
is who has the burden of proof to determine whether or not it's testimonial for purposes of admitting it into evidence.
I would think that the Commonwealth has the burden of proof because they have the burden of proof at a probable cause or at a show cause hearing to put on evidence. And it could be attacked by the defendant, but that was done when we moved to object for its admission or to call it hearsay. In addition to that, I think the problem is even if you agree that it's non-testimonial, and the problem I have with that is the way it came in is the Commonwealth also wants you to assume that it's based on no evidence before any court so far, not the trial court, not the Court of Appeals, and not the Supreme Court. And lastly,
counsel, let me ask you this. We're in the context of a probation revocation hearing, right? And the U.S. Supreme Court has said due process protections are attenuated and at least some hearsay can come in. So understand the Court of Appeals went down the line of traditional confrontation clause analysis, but we're in the mode of this attenuated due process form of confrontation, right?
Correct.
Okay. So some hearsay comes in, some hearsay does not. Why does this give us the correct analysis under due process for why this does not come in?
I think to answer that question, one has to look at the indicia of reliability, which I think is sort of the quote that's often thrown around that we have. I concede that a probable or show cause hearing has some lower standards. I think for Morrissey, it tells us that we've lowered the standards. However, society has an interest. And we have a particular high interest when we're going to take away someone's freedom. So I think that's a little different. But when we do that, and I think the Morrissey talks about that we need to have verifiable facts that exercise of discretion will be informed by an accurate knowledge of the parolee's behavior. So in other words, we need to know those facts are reliable. If you look at Crawford and you look at the overturning of Ohio versus Roberts, which Ohio versus Roberts, as the court recalls, the Supreme Court case was one where the individual was there for credit card or check fraud or something, and so there was a preliminary hearing, and the witness was unavailable at trial but testified at the preliminary hearing, and the defendant got up there and testified, and they used his rebuttal. And Ohio versus Roberts said that was acceptable. That was okay because they had an indicia of reliability. The Supreme Court in Crawford said, no, no, no. It doesn't have that indicia of reliability because it wasn't subject to cross-examination. And that seems to be the fundamental aspect of truly getting to the truth, is that ability to subject someone or for a defendant to have the ability to cross-examine that witness as to what's being said. Now, we know this
court you want to, like the Court of Appeals, you want to take us down the path of Crawford and traditional criminal trial confrontation analysis, but until the U.S. Supreme Court aligns probation revocation due process with that analysis, it just seems like we're going down the wrong path, perhaps.
Well, there's two ways to look at that, in my opinion. This court has determined under the Henderson analysis that we're going to go through at a show cause hearing, we're going to consider this reliability, and we're going to look at this balancing test that we have, or I think there's the two tests that are there, is to determine what comes in. The problem with that is it's never been laid out in the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's a sort of a Virginia has probably adopted this from other states, but that's the analysis this court has put before us. But when you look at the holding in Cox, which is using the same logic, says, but there's certain things that we're not going to allow in that are hearsay. For example, one probation officer can't testify to what another probationer is going to say. Now, I realize that's an inferior court, but that's the guidance that a trial court has before it.
As I understand it, the defense stipulated that the defendant had breached the condition of his probation. He was convicted of some major felonies.
That's correct.
So does that matter to the analysis? In other words, it's one thing for the probationer to come in and say, you know, I didn't violate the terms of my probation. I tried to get to the probation officer, but he was not there, and now he's saying, I didn't show up for my appointment, or the bus was late, and by the time I get there, he was gone. I mean, that's one thing. It's another thing to say, you know what? I did violate the terms of my probation. I committed a pretty significant crime. Now all we're talking about is, well, all right, so factually what happened? The defendant knows that as well as the newspaper, as well as anybody else. Does that affect the fundamental fairness associated with a due process analysis?
This court answered that question in Turner v. Commonwealth in 2009. And the Turner case was one where an individual went before the court and said, yes, I have missed my appointments. I missed 4 appointments. I made 10 appointments, whatever it may have been. I am in violation. However, the court went further, and the Commonwealth went further in that particular case to show this something with his polygraph. He was unreliable in his behavior because he didn't show well on the polygraph examination. And this court said, and properly so, I believe, was, that's going too far with polygraphs. We're not telling you you can't use them as an investigative tool, but you can't use it as a tool. But what it ultimately, I think, the case, how it lines up with this one, is said, we can't tell what the judge was deciding when he parceled out that punishment. Was he relying on the polygraph, or is he relying on the fact that he admitted to the 4 prior briefs? And that's what we have here. Mr. Mooney conceded he was in violation of those charges. But it's the aggravated, sensational facts that came out, or alleged facts that came out, that make it sound much more egregious than may have what happened here.
Well, can't he take the stand and say, that's not at all what happened?
He could take the stand, and then all of a sudden,
I know it's a technical dilemma.
He's forced to, but I think, Justice, you're going, is, let's assume for a second we don't go down this Crawford 14th Amendment, 6th Amendment right to confront, but let's look at the indicia of reliability that it has here, and that's what I think is even more important, is you've got double, triple, probably quadruple hearsay that's coming before this court. You've got a Commonwealth getting up and saying, okay, here's some, judge, you want to know what happened? Let me tell you what happened.
Well, the Commonwealth said to the judge, I'm going to go with the quotations from her testimony. And there was a single paragraph of what was proffered to be quotations from her trial testimony, in which the victim testified, in which the defendant had an opportunity to cross-examine, in which the defendant was convicted of strangulation, abduction, and third offense, domestic violence. What was it about that the trial court didn't understand as to what he was or she was receiving?
I know I'm not supposed to ask questions and they were in a rhetorical position, but how do we know that was her exact quotations from the trial? How do we know that wasn't a blog that somebody posted and said this is what was said? How do we know we even have the right complaining witnesses' testimony, if at all? How do we know it wasn't from a preliminary hearing testimony?
Well, one way you would know, it's a fair question, is you would proffer to the court, that's not true. That's not what happened. I've got my man sitting right here. What she just told you is, in fact, I reject her proffer. I don't accept it at all. But the proffer was made, and the objection was not that this is that she was the prosecutor was misleading the court, but that it shouldn't be admitted. There was no objection. This is not what happened, Your Honor. This is not a fair recitation of the testimony.
I can't find the exact quote that I said, but somewhere in my record, I indicate that we disagree with those facts. Now, did we put on Mr. Mooney to testify to him? No.
Well, your objection is, just for the record, I would tell the court I object to the hearsay from the hearsay, his inability to confront. That's quotes that are quoted from here. I understand. And that's it.
Well, there's someone that's cut off there, but that's what the record has, so that's what I'm bound by and what I've got to go with. But to get back to your original question, I guess, is it's difficult from a trial standpoint to object to something that we don't know where it's coming from, what it is, and what information it has in it to go with. I just don't know that. My client, one of the standards that we put out, I think, is in the Morris, he talks about that you have notice of what's going to be used against you. We had no notice of a transcript coming in. It'd be different if they had an actual court transcript or maybe even a police officer's record. But the message that's being sent out now from the Court of Appeals is that if you can find something on the internet, doesn't you don't have to tell us who it comes from, you don't have to tell us where it's from, then that is going to become evidence, because all you have to do is get up there and say, well, it's not testimonial because it's written by a reporter that we don't know, or it comes off the internet, so therefore it becomes usable for the prosecutor in all future cases on a show cause violation, because they go surfing the internet. And I realize we didn't have the internet 20 years ago when a lot of this jurisprudence was made and we had confrontation and we had things that were being substituted now. But I think the message being sent is, you don't even have to tell us where you got it from. And the burden being shifted back to the defendant is, well, you not only have to object to the proffer, but you got to be more specific. You got to tell us what you're doing. But I think the court can go through his analysis and look at this and kind of determine what the court's position was, which was hearsay is admissible. So it's a show cause hearing.
Are you making a Crawford argument, or are you making a state evidentiary law hearsay argument?
I'm making both. And I stand by both of those arguments. I think I've made those. I hope I have anyway, but that's what I believe. I'd like to reserve my last 3 minutes if I could, unless there's a question that needs to be asked right now. I'd like to.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the court, Kelsey Bolger on behalf of the Commonwealth in this case. The Court of Appeals correctly held that the defendant's 14th Amendment right to confront adverse witnesses at his revocation hearing was not violated by this admission of certain statements. At issue here is a newspaper article. We know this is a newspaper article because there was an unobjected to proffer that the prosecutor was reading from a newspaper article. We also have a finding in the Court of Appeals opinion that this was a, although we don't know the source, we know that it was a newspaper article, and I don't believe that the defendant has assigned error to that holding. Within the newspaper article, there were essentially two sets of statements. We have the statements from the victim in these offenses, and then we have a set of statements from the judge at the trial court. The first step here, I think, is for the court to analyze whether these statements were testimonial and whether we even need to engage in this good cause analysis. Because if they were not testimonial, then we have a state evidentiary ruling on whether they were hearsay, and we're just talking about whether they are demonstrably reliable.
Is due process confrontation the Crawford test that is typically used for the guilt phase of a criminal trial?
No. So due process confrontation involves the good cause analysis,
right,
whereas Sixth Amendment confrontation is typically going to...
That's I was just trying to wrap my brain around. You know, we're in the mode now, we're post-Ohio versus Roberts, we've got Crawford, and that's criminal trials. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, it's a different standard in probation revocation. So the Court of Appeals is a traditional Crawford analysis. I was just wondering if that's the right approach. It may be, but I'm not sure it is.
I think the beginning might be the same analysis. Okay. So the beginning of whether these statements are testimonial. That analysis seems to be the same under the Sixth Amendment or the 14th Amendment.
It seems to me you could have flat out something that is testimonial that in the midst of the guilt phase, the court would say, no, you need, for example, a DNA analysis or a DFS certificate. You need that live body there in the chair to authenticate whatever. But if it's highly reliable, et cetera, then maybe it's perfectly fine in a probation revocation.
I think that's correct. And I think that's the main difference, many differences, obviously, between the Sixth Amendment and the 14th Amendment, but the main difference in this analysis, which is that we can use the good cause analysis. So we can apply the balancing test, apply the reliability test, and say this is sufficiently reliable to let this in, and we don't need to allow the defendant to cross-examine the witness.
But the definition of what's testimonial is the same in either instance, though, right?
I think that's true, yes. So I think that part of the analysis is the same at first.
If you don't get the good cause, you don't need an exception if you don't have testimonial, at least under the Sixth Amendment analysis.
Yes.
And then all we're left with is state evidentiary law, which is very fluid on the point.
Correct.
And has nothing to do with Crawford. It has everything to do with just basic reliability and good cause standards.
Correct. And I think there, then, obviously, we have a different standard. We're talking about an abuse of discretion. And, of course, it would be the Commonwealth's position that the trial court, if this court holds that these statements were not testimonial, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in allowing them, despite the fact that they were hearsay, because they were sufficiently reliable. We know that they were from a newspaper article.
Does that make it reliable because it's from a newspaper? I mean, is that the way it works?
I think there is a difference between demonstrably reliable and we absolutely know this is true. And again, we're at a revocation hearing. I think the court can say, well, I have this proffer from the prosecutor that says he's reading from a newspaper article about this case, a case that the defendant had already stipulated had happened, already stipulated he had been convicted, and already stipulated that he had received 10 years. So we have these statements that are essentially corroborated by the defendant's stipulation.
In the sense of, yeah, there was a trial and some people probably testified there, but we don't know what they said.
And that, I think, is why it would have been important to object to that proffer of I'm reading from a newspaper article. Because at that point, had there been an objection, the prosecutor could have moved to introduce the article and the parties could have argued about the reliability of the source.
But when he makes the hearsay objection, isn't he basically doing that?
I don't think so. I think, so we have a separate proffer and then we have an objection. Our first objection, or the defense's first objection, is to I'm going to object to reading from a newspaper article. So we have an objection to the contents of the newspaper article, not the assertion that it is a newspaper article. And again, I point to the Court of Appeals opinion that labels it as a newspaper article, finds it's a newspaper article, and there's no assigned error to that.
Right. I mean, I guess the thing I'm saying is just because it's in the paper doesn't mean it's true.
I think that's true. Yes. But I think, again, at a revocation hearing, the standards of the admission for hearsay, it's demonstrably reliable, and the court did not abuse its discretion in finding that this newspaper article was demonstrably reliable in light of all of
it. It wasn't a summary, was it? I mean, it wasn't an article just, you know, here's what we saw happen in trial. It was purporting to be a verbatim recitation of the victim's testimony from the witness stand.
Correct. Yes, I think it was purporting to be specific quotes from the victim.
It was written in first person, wasn't it? I gently woke up. He told me I wasn't going anywhere. He put his hands around my neck.
Right.
And so it's a reporter allegedly recounting open court testimony, which could be easily refuted if it were untrue, and putting in a newspaper saying, here's what the victim said, as opposed to what newspapers typically do, which is to say, here's generally what happened. Isn't that different?
I think if anything, it probably makes it more reliable to use those quotations and to say, here's exactly what she testified. Because we're not so much worried about bias or the source in that case, because the reporter is not saying, here's what I think about what she said, or here's what it sounded like when she said. He or the reporter is saying, here's what happened at this trial. And again, that's corroborated by his three new felony convictions.
To me it seems like somebody, I don't know who it was, said that this is what they heard at the trial. Quote, blah, blah, blah. I don't know who the guy is. I don't know whether he hears well. I don't know whether he can write. But that's what he says, and he put it in quotes, so it must be true. I mean, it seems like what you're telling me.
I think that is sufficiently less reliable than saying, this is from a newspaper article.
What if they said this is from the Inquirer, not to cast any dispersion on the Inquirer? But how do we know they weren't reading from a reputable newspaper, a local observer like the Chesterfield Observer? I'm just having real difficulty concluding that a newspaper article is inherently reliable.
And that's why I think there had to have been an objection to, I am reading from a newspaper article, so that the parties could argue the credibility of the source. But there was no objection. There was no objection, and the only thing in the record is corroboration of what was read from the newspaper article.
The objection was, quote, I object, quote, to any newspaper article about a case, end quote. I think that puts the court on notice of what his objection is.
So I would respectfully disagree with that, because I think even that objection is conceding, yes, the prosecutor is reading from a newspaper article. I object to the contents of the newspaper article coming into evidence, but I don't object to his proffer that this is, in fact, a newspaper article.
What difference does it make that it is a newspaper article? That is our question. What makes it reliable because it's a newspaper article?
I think the court can look to the primary purpose of most newspaper articles, which is to inform the public. And I understand anyone may have very different opinions on that, but that generally is seen as the primary purpose, to inform the public, to convey information.
Even the President of the United States has different opinions on that.
I have heard that.
This is how is the fact that it's a newspaper article make it demonstrably reliable?
I think the court has to look to the primary purpose and all other relevant circumstances, which is that it's corroborated and the defendant did not offer any contradictory evidence.
He said, I disagree with the recitation of the facts.
Yes, but he did not say, this is not what happened at trial. Here's what happened at trial. And that doesn't even necessarily require, I'm not sure that it requires any independent testimony from the defendant. I think there could have been a proffer that is not correct. That is not what happened at trial. That was not her testimony.
He said, I would dispute many of the facts that the Commonwealth says.
And
so
then,
isn't that saying that was not?
I don't think that's necessarily what that's saying, because then I believe he goes on to say, but we have no intention of bringing this witness here, we have no intention of cross-examining her,
because I was convicted of these offenses.
Correct.
But I disagree with the facts from the newspaper.
And there's no indication of what facts he's disagreeing with. There's no proffer, there's nothing to contradict the facts that the Commonwealth put into evidence. And that is part of the analysis of reliability, is did the defendant contradict these facts with any evidence of his own? And he didn't.
Is there any need to make a showing of demonstrable reliability or good cause or any of the exceptions to the general rule if the Sixth Amendment is not implicated at all because it's not testimonial? Because at that point, we're not dealing with the Constitution at all. We're dealing with state law.
Right, and the question would be whether the trial court abused its discretion in allowing this evidence in.
We're beating around a lot of different bushes, but they're very different. Crawford is a Sixth Amendment analysis. If you can't pass testimonial, the game is over. You don't ask any other question. You don't care where the evidence came from. The Constitution is not implicated. The only thing left is hearsay, and as we've held, hearsay is frequently admitted in probation violations. There is no confrontation clause issue in that respect.
I think that's correct. I think that even the more recent cases out of this court, even Johnson just last year, seem to still suggest that at a revocation hearing, there still should be some sort of analysis of whether the hearsay is demonstrably reliable.
There's got to be some abuse of discretion standard.
Correct. And here, the trial court did not abuse its discretion, obviously, because we have this corroboration, we don't have any contradicting evidence, and I would argue to the court that there was not a sufficient objection to the proffer of what we were talking about.
If it's purported to be a quote from the trial, wouldn't that make it testimonial hearsay?
I think that technically, yes, it would be testimonial, but it does not offend the defendant's due process right because he had the opportunity to cross-examine that. So it's only a testimonial problem.
I'm sorry. And then we come to the question of, is it a quote from the trial? Is it a quote from the preliminary hearing? Is it a quote given to the officers when they were investigating the offense? And I know the word testimony is there, which I guess is your strongest argument, but we don't know any of that, which is a little disconcerting.
I agree that there is not a lot of evidence in the record about this newspaper article, but I think
there's
even
no evidence there, in the record about this purported newspaper article.
Sure. But I think even if the court holds that these statements were testimonial, the court can consider the good cause analysis. Just the fact that the statements may have been testimonial does not mean that they were admitted in violation of the defendant's due process right.
Does the trial court have to go through the good cause analysis, or do we do that here?
I think that this court has indicated that the trial court certainly should engage in the good cause analysis.
The trial court didn't do that because the trial court basically took a position that it's a revocation hearing, it's hearsay, it's admissible.
That's correct.
It strikes me as strange when I read the purported testimony from the purported newspaper article that it's a block quote of almost 200 words with no ellipsis, which would indicate that it's simply just that it was just a narrative, and it's typically not what you see in a newspaper article. I mean, yeah, you've got it in front of you. It leaves me quizzical about what the source truly is, because it's not the way newspaper articles are typically written.
Well. And to clarify, obviously, that is the way that it appeared in the record. I do see my time is up.
You can answer your question.
That is the way it appears in the record, but that is an issue with the lack of evidence in the record, is that we don't know if these were snippets that were put together from the newspaper article.
Doesn't that matter?
I don't think it does, because, again, there's no objection to the proffer that all of these statements are coming from a newspaper article. Had there been an objection, the prosecutor would have had to admit that article or would have moved for its admission.
Quote, I object to any newspaper article about a case. End quote. How much precision beyond that is required?
I think the
court was notified. I don't think you ought to be reading from a newspaper article.
Which is different from saying, I disagree with his assertion that he's reading from a newspaper article.
That distinction is lost upon me, but my question's answered, so thank you.
Thank you. Your
thank
time
you.
Has expired. Rebuttal?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think some of my rebuttal requirements have been brought to the court's attention. I would bring up one or two other comments. One of them, and I think Justice Powell, you kind of alluded, is newspaper articles. Times have changed, and I'm old enough, and I think maybe a few of you may be old enough to remember the days when you got the 6 o'clock news and you got nothing but the news. These are the facts, nothing but the facts. Now if you turn on CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, you get one reporter interviewing another reporter who's talked to another reporter about what happened, and you don't really get an objective. You get somebody's opinion of what they think and how it's been framed by that particular network. We don't know, and I think if it's a National Enquirer, is it the New York Times, is it a newspaper, is it a blog somewhere, is it a high school paper saying this is what happened? Also, what we don't know is there usually is a newspaper article that may have, and oh, by the way, here's the other side. This person said this, this, and this, However, the judge determined that that was not reliable evidence, or maybe that they didn't believe that part of it, but they did believe this part. We don't have that. Nobody has it. I was not given an opportunity. My client was not given an opportunity. The court didn't have an opportunity. The court concluded, and I understand why the court concluded, is it's a show cause hearing. Hearsay is admissible. But now you've got not just hearsay, you've got multiple layers of hearsay. And that sort of begs the difference of what really is an indicia of reliability. If one person reports what another person said and another person said to them, is that really what we're looking for in reliability? And are we also looking at, as I think was also mentioned here, this clearly was testimonial. There's no question if this is a quote from this person is such one. Do we now take it out of the Crawford analysis strictly because a newspaper reported it, what happened? Otherwise, we could get all kinds of evidence in by just going to newspaper article and say, forget the Crawford analysis now, because the way it stands now, if it's a newspaper article, it's no longer testimonial because it's changed from testimonial at trial or investigation or a preliminary hearing to now non-testimony because it's being reported by a quote. I don't know what it was reported by. I don't know where the evidence came from. I think that's a fundamental unfairness given to my client. And if you go through the Crawford, you look at the balancing test, and you look at how we didn't accept in Cox a probation officer.
Is it relevant at all in any of this analysis that you chose not and said we don't want to bring the victim to the hearing?
We didn't. I see my time's running out, but
you may answer the question.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead and answer the question.
It was never our intention. We conceded we did this. We were guilty of that. I couldn't object to that. He could have put it on. But it wasn't our plan to say, let's bring this person in. We didn't subpoena them. We didn't know how to even get in touch with them. But that's all that I was saying there was, we accept responsibility for X. We just don't accept it for A, B, C, and D that now has been brought to our attention that wasn't in the major violation report, that wasn't done, that my client had no idea that was coming blindsiding him at that or me at that trial as to what happened. So I hope that answers your question. I didn't know if there's anything else.
Your time has expired. Call the next case.